Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, February 26th, 2026, we are delighted to host this discussion on the challenges that immigration policy poses for American businesses. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you'd like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Simon Hankinson, Patrick Shin, James Rogers, and Chris Thomas as our speakers, and Randy Johnson as our moderator. Mr. Johnson is an immigration law and policy fellow at Cornell Law School. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom, so that we'll have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Randy, the floor is yours.
Yeah, hey, Matt just came in and told me I was muted. So there you go. I'm the oldest guy on the phone, probably. And I am on my cell phone, so it's a little awkward here. But look, we've got an hour here, a lot of issues going on. We're not going to be able to talk about everything in the immigration space, of course, but we're blessed with some really experts on the phone here. And let me just say a little bit more about myself. I'm more of an employment lawyer, but I have spent, as Patrick Chen knows, negotiating two comprehensive immigration reform bills. Of course, none were successful, but that's another story. And I've testified many times on Capitol Hill, including on E-Verify and including on Arizona E-Verify issues. But with that, let's go to our first speaker, Chris Thomas, who's a partner with Holland and Hart. Chris is one of my speakers when I teach a course at Syracuse on the intersections of immigration and employment law. And he's got decades of experience and just sort of where the rubber meets the road on advising employers when the government comes in to investigate I-9 verification problems and generally worksite enforcement, along with sort of broader international issues also. Anyways, he just really cuts to the chase and what's going on and can provide a perspective, I hope, Chris, also on not just under this administration, but looking back and doing some comparative analysis, given your entire background. Chris is out in Denver right now, but of course, is all over the country. And Chris, I'll turn it over to you now.
Well, great. Good to be here. And thank you for the invitation, Randy. As we talk about immigration, it's funny. I was telling this group right before we started, I started in the realm of criminal defense. It was a wild and crazy area of law. I thought, well, I'll seek shelter in the world of immigration. And so I went to that. And only a few months after that, 9/11 ended up happening and the world of immigration was turned upside down. As we look at what's happened, you know, we've seen things ebb and flow over the decades here, I suppose. But one thing that is always clear are the three central concerns that employers have. They're worried about civil exposure from I-9 audits. They're worried now about criminal exposure more than ever. And they're worried about the operational impact. Are they going to be able to find the necessary workers to be able to keep their company going? So as we talk about that, what have we seen in terms of changes since, say, the Biden administration? Well, we have seen a substantial uptick in the world of I-9 audits, no question about it, with employers now very nervous throughout the country about whether they're in compliance. What do they need to do? Do they need to clean up their paperwork? Is it time to enroll in E-Verify, et cetera? In addition to that, on the criminal front, we are seeing that there's a real concern, especially in the wake of the memorandum that was published by Pam Bondi, the attorney general, on February 5th last year, where she said that immigration-related offenses would now be the investigative and charging priorities of the United States government. That, I think, initially was missed by much of the immigration bar and others, but the truth is we have watched that start to unfold. What was previously an administrative matter, an I-9 audit, in the current environment often starts with an I-9 audit, then leads to raids, and then leads to grand jury subpoenas. And we are seeing that pattern throughout the country as things unfold. And that kind of leads to the remaining concern that it is the operational impact aspect of it all. Companies that are worried not only about whether maybe they didn't vet people quite appropriately, or maybe they even tried to, but they couldn't tell whether the documentation was authentic as they let them on board and completed the I-9 process. And along the way, they're now worried that, you know, they might get that notice of inspection and it could turn into a raid. And what happens if they lose 75% of their workforce tomorrow? So all of that's kind of combining. I think I'll just add a couple quick layers to the concern as we give the high level review here. And that is, there's also concern among employers right now about what do we do with all the revocations that are taking place? CHNV parole, Cuban, Haitian, Nicaraguan, Venezuelan parole was revoked, and that affected some 500,000 people. And then temporary protected status has been revoked by for numerous nationalities at this point. And on the list goes, where companies are saying, okay, we can't hire undocumented workers. We get it. We also can't seem to keep the ones who we thought were documented. What are our options? And so that leads to questions about what are the visa options out there? How could we bring people in then under different categories? One of the programs that in particular has attracted a lot of attention recently is the H-1B category. Not only that $100,000 fee that was going to be imposed, which has substantial loopholes to it at this point, and we recognize that, but also the enforcement environment that continues, concerns that the Department of Labor will take a look at them under this Project Firewall, looking at their public access files, et cetera. The on-site visits that come from Fraud Detection National Security, FDNS, and whether some kind of irregularity could be found that could refer the matter for further investigation. So under prior administrations, the concerns were kind of civil-related fines, et cetera. Now, the concern is really all three: fines, potential criminal charges if they've misstepped in any way, and of course, the greater concern relating to operational impact, or at least equal concern of operational impact in the current environment. So with all of that, I think I'll pause and turn it back to Randy, if he's with us still. If not, happy to keep going. I think I'll keep going. I'll give you an example of how one of these cases played out recently. In a recent situation, we had an individual, and a lot of these cases aren't hitting the press at all, right? But it was an individual who owned several hotels. And so along the way, he got a notice of inspection where Homeland Security Investigations came in and said, hey, we'd like to see your Forms I-9. He thought, okay, paperwork review, no big deal. So he ends up producing all of his I-9s. A short time later, the agents came back now with warrants in hand and executed searches on each of his hotel properties and ended up questioning a lot of people. He thought, okay, well, that's a concern too. Just lost a substantial percentage of my workforce, but still hadn't bothered to involve legal counsel in the whole story. And then suddenly we get to a point where he's now getting grand jury subpoenas, not him directly, but his accountant, others. And that's when he decides it's time to call us. And he calls us and says, look, I don't think I was employing anybody unlawfully. I'm enrolled in E-Verify. I thought I was doing everything right, but I know they did take some of our employees away, et cetera. What do I do now? And I think that it's that level of uncertainty, right, that some of these employers are trying to grapple with and figure out, well, how do I do the right thing so that I don't get in trouble? And with that, Randy, we'll turn it back to you.
Hey, thanks, Chris. And moving over to Matt's chair, actually. Our next speaker is James Roger, who's senior counsel to America First Legal. Long sort of a variety of issues, like a Renaissance man, I think, James. And before joining American First Legal, he was senior litigation counsel at the Solicitor General Office of the Arizona Attorney General's Office, spearheaded a various number of lawsuits against the Biden administration, and was a graduate of Harvard Law School and University of Cambridge. Well, we won't hold Harvard against you on this one, but I do want to mention that one of the first things I worked on at the U.S. Chamber was a challenge that went to the Supreme Court. I think it was the Whiting case, James. And of course, we lost at the Supreme Court, I think, on almost every basis. But that wound up laying the basis for our negotiations with Lamar Smith on a mandatory e-verified bill. So Arizona's obviously been in the forefront of issues, including, you know, Senator McCain and Flake and others. So, James, I'll turn it over to you now. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. And in Harvard's defense, about a quarter of the class every year is a member of the Federal Society. So there's some redeeming qualities to the university. I'm going to talk about the I-9 process. Before 1986, there was no requirement for employers to check lawful authorization to work in the United States. And that process, the law that required that's the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, it was almost 9 years in the making. Jimmy Carter first spearheaded this idea of legalizing, giving amnesty to illegal aliens who are here, and as part of a grand bargain to get the political compromise to get that accepted, increasing enforcement against illegal aliens who are here, and imposing requirements that employers can only hire eight persons who are legally authorized to work in the United States. And so there were various iterations and tries. It failed multiple times until finally in the mid to late 80s, they reached this grand bargain where the different part, because different groups were all opposed to it. Civil rights groups said it led to discrimination. Agriculture employers didn't like it because they thought they'd lose their labor force. Chamber of Commerce opposed it because they thought it would impose burdens. Anyway, so they adopted this law that had three legs. The first one was stronger border enforcement. It increased funding for the Border Patrol and INS. And then it also imposed the employer sanctions. I-9 was the second leg. So it required employers to verify the lawful authorization for employees to work through the I-9 form. And then the third leg was to give amnesty. And as part of that, it also gave funds to states to help in the transition, provide services to newly amnestied aliens who had become citizens. Now, part of the problem is that the grand bargain amnestied these people, but the enforcement didn't really happen as promised. And what happened it also altered the incentives. Illegal aliens saw that there was this, now the amnesty was potentially on the table in the future. They saw it had happened once. There's a hope it could happen again. And so it actually increased the pull factor for more illegal aliens to come. And then there were critical flaws in the I-9 system. It works on paper documents. So generally you show us your social security card to show that you're authorized to work in the United States. And then you show a form of official government picture ID to prove that you're the person listed on the social security card. Well, as anyone who's ever seen a social security card knows, they don't have the most robust anti-fraud features. And so illegal aliens could easily get fake social security cards with a real number of a real person, of a American citizen, but with their name, with the alien's name on the card. And then they can, in a lot of states, aliens can get driver's licenses. They can get an official government ID with their real name and then a fake social security card with their real name and a number that doesn't match. And it was an easy way to circumvent the I-9 process. That still works to this day. Typically, when they would do that, Social Security Administration eventually would see that there's not a match between the name and the number as the employer's withholding Social Security. And they'd get a no match letter, which says, you know, this name and this number doesn't match. And then generally employers would just go to the employee and say, hey, I got this no match letter. You know, I need you to bring your paperwork back in. And they just come in with a different fake Social Security card with a different number. So in 1996, the Congress passed another law called the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. And it called for the establishment of a new pilot program to electronically verify employment authorization. And that's what led eventually to the creation of E-Verify. Now, E-Verify is a voluntary system. I looked up a stat that said as of the early 2020s, an estimated 97% of employers still just did the paper-based I-9 system, and didn't use E-Verify. But starting in 2008, states started imposing state level requirements making e-verify mandatory. Arizona led the charge. There's lots of news in the press, SB 1070. Various parts of that bill were held unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, but the e-verify provision was upheld. And so since then, Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, and Tennessee have all imposed mandatory e-verify requirements of one type or another. Some of them, like in Arizona, it's for all employers. Some states, it's for only employers above a certain number. In Georgia, it's 11 or more, North Carolina, 25 or more. And what the e-verify system does is it checks in the government actual government databases and verifies that the name and the Social Security match. And so it's not a perfect system, but it's better than the I-9 system. If we were to impose nationwide e-verify, it would be a tremendous boon to employers, in my opinion, because employers face a dilemma. They have different demands. There's these laws. Part of the grand bargain in 1986 was they imposed restrictions on discriminating against employees based on their national origin. So if an employer, they have this one pull on one side that if they're too harsh and they're too they put too much effort in trying to verify employees' status, they can be faced with discrimination charges. But if they don't, they can face enforcement from the federal government. And in the middle, if they do try to voluntarily sign up for e-verify in a state where it's not mandatory, then they face the prospect of losing out to competitors who can pay lower wages than they can. So mandatory e-verify nationwide would help equalize the playing field and force all employers to follow the same standards. There's a problem now in certain states. We've heard that illegal aliens will actually get IDs with the name of another person. So there, of course, there's always holes, but it'd always be kind of a cat and mouse kind of game. But e-verify is a huge step up from the paper system, and making it mandatory nationwide would equalize the playing field. And then all those holes, you know, there would be a constant push to plug the holes, but that can be done. So I'll leave it there.
Yeah, thanks. And I think, so we get into Q&A a little bit, you might want to talk a little bit about would you be comfortable mandatory e-verify with broad preemption of state laws on verification issues, et cetera, which we all negotiated with Lamar Smith. But anyways, our next speaker is Patrick Chen. I've known Patrick for a long time. He's currently Vice President for Immigration Policy at the U.S. Chamber. His position used to be under me before I left. Patrick's was with a law firm for many years practicing law, but before that he was with the Department of Justice, and he was confirmed unanimously by the U.S. Senate. Now, when was the last time anybody was confirmed unanimously by the U.S. Senate?
Cared about me.
Well, now you wouldn't even get through. As special counsel for immigration-related unfair employment practices, and was also counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I believe under Orrin Hatch, Patrick, if we go back that far together. It was a lot of experience, graduate of Brigham Young, American University, adjunct professor. He's now at the chamber. Of course, they're involved in the H-1B litigation, but among many other things. Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. And I'm actually really excited to be back involved with the Federalist Society. In preparation of this presentation, I didn't want to look bad for you, Randy. I went back and looked at some of the materials. And in October 2005, when the magazine was still called Engage, some of you may be old enough to remember that, the legal journal from the Federalist Society, I had an article in that October 2005 issue, where I urged that immigration policy should be based on our national interest, right? What's good for America? It's not kicking everybody out or letting everybody in. And I know nobody really believes that, but this is too much of the discussion suggests or give the impression that one side want to let everybody in, the other side want to let everybody out, right? You think that, Chris and I are the private sector guys on this call, and Chris certainly has a lot more expertise than I do. But I'm listening to James, and I'm thinking, you know what? He's pointing out every problem that I also saw in the last 30 years of my career, first half of 32 years, actually. In fact, James, you referenced 1986. Randy and I are probably the only ones who are legal adults at that time in the 86 reform when we were old enough to drive and vote. And in your case, Randy, you were, already a leader in the field, and I was just coming along. But what happened in 86, right? I'm going to come to you on a couple of issues raised from the employer's perspective, but also keep in mind that I spent the first half of my 30 plus year career trying to kick people out of the country and representing law enforcement. So I understand I have a little bit of that background, right? 86, all right, the I-9, for the first time, as James said, employers were responsible for verifying two things, right? Identity and work authorization of new people they were hiring, okay? As a compromise to the compromise, Senator Kennedy and Congressman Frank, both of Massachusetts, pushed forward a countervailing provision, really creating the concept of immigration-related employment discrimination modeled after Title VII, right? And that was the first time that concept, was introduced to American law. What ended up for employers, though, is that you have this tension pulling you from both sides here, right? So let's just use the current environment as an example, okay? Chris, you mentioned about, the cancellation of or termination of several humanitarian programs, right? What ended up there was the a pretty abrupt termination of over a million authorized workers in the country, right? At an environment where certainly coming from the business community, we would argue, right? And we believe we have this data to support it, that there is a worker shortage to begin with. But let's look at the plight or the dilemma for employers in that situation, okay? In the previous administration, there was a different kind of policy. Whether those on the call agree or disagree with it, you can't deny the fact that a lot of people came into the country and, they were given work authorization, right? Now, for the employers who need people to work for them, right? They were told all the while, certainly since 1986, don't hire illegal workers. So these folks come forward with legal papers to show work authorization, right? And the employers, they have no reason not to hire them. They were legal, they need people. But also think about this. What if an employer said, I really disagree with Biden's open border policy, and therefore, since you look like a Venezuelan parolee to me, I'm not going to hire you. What do you think the Biden EEOC would have done to that employer, right? So you got this situation where employers have no reason not to hire these people. You would get into hot water with the civil rights enforcement in the previous administration, probably this one too, if they said something blatant like that, right? And so they hire them, they're working for them, then in comes this new policy where the work authorization was ended. Now, here is where I think James and I agree to a great extent on the inadequacies of the I-9 system. You show up for work, you have your papers, the employers use their best judgment to look at these papers and say, yep, you look like you're Chris Thomas, that looks like you. You can work until, whenever, okay? There's no mechanism under the I-9 system to say, to alert the employers that work authorization has ended in midstream. You're counting on the employees to come forward, right? And many did, but the smart ones never did. Why would they? Right? So then with the heightened enforcement environment, ICE shows up with a subpoena, right? A warrant. And they say, oh, you have all these illegal workers on your staff, right? Then it becomes, argument back and forth, did I know? Did you know? Did you have reason to know? Right. It's the whole concept of constructive knowledge is a real vulnerability for employers. So I agree with James. I think that, E-Verify has taken up, has brought us a long way. In fact, I was the one when I was working on judiciary to broker the deal between Senators John Kyle and Ted Kennedy on making E-Verify available, not mandatory, but available nationwide. So, it's something that we certainly understand the merits of it. But what does E-Verify not to do, right? It does not, it's great at catching document fraud. It's not nearly as effective in catching identity fraud, okay? So if we're gonna have something, we're gonna mandate some kind of a verification system, let's address that, right? Let's provide, some cover, some safe harbor for employers who want to do the right thing, okay? And also, Randy, as you said, preempt states from coming up with their own laws, right? That not only is it a problem for states to mandate something that's voluntary under you know, federal law, but sometimes the states don't always get it right. Okay. So on that issue, I'll stop there. On, you know, just a broader picture, you mentioned H-1Bs and others. You know, look, I cannot say it. I'm sure Simon will raise this as well, because both James and Simon have been, you know, consular officer. They've seen way more cases than I ever have. I can't say to you with a straight face that there's no fraud, right? But how do we address it? Do we address fraud? Do we prevent fraud by making the system, the program, unavailable for everybody? Or do we really come down? And I'm speaking for myself, by the way, not for the Chamber of Commerce. I haven't cleared this position with anyone, okay? Well, you'll know better, Randy. But I'm just saying, isn't it better to go after those who violate the law and make them actually regret violating the law, as opposed to making the program unavailable for everybody on the front end? So, and a lot of the things that we've seen, you know, whether it's the $100,000 fee or some of the other regs that we've seen proposed, right, they go towards clogging the talent pipeline and would impact the fraudsters and the legitimate users at the same time. And I would say that any kind of a reform should look at it from the opposite end. I've talked way longer than the time you've given me already. So let me stop there and give Simon a chance.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick. And maybe later we'll get into why the H-1Bs under Spence and Abraham, we raised the cap to 195,000, and H-1Bs were the godchild sort of way back then. And now they're sort of on the low rung of the ladder, and why that is. It's an interesting phenomenon, I think, when you look back over the last 20 years, H-1Bs. And so let's go to Simon Hankinson. Simon is had a kid on that. He should look a little happier on his bio there if you get a chance to look at it. But Simon is a senior research fellow in the Border Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation. Certainly an eclectic background. He was a foreign service officer in India, Fiji, Ghana, Togo, Washington, D.C., Marseille, Nairobi. And prior to entering the State Department, he was a lawyer in London and taught history, English, and drama at a private school in Miami. Well, master's degree in modern history from St. Andrews, Scotland, presumably did some golf there, a degree from College of Law in London, a master's degree in international security from the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. Simon, I know you guys are busy up there at Heritage, and so thank you for joining us.
You know, over my first paper I ever wrote was on the IRC Act, the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 86. And I was then a consular officer for, 23 years in Foreign Service, but doing real consular work in India for 2 years, and then Fiji and Ghana and other places. And what I learned was that, you know, Patrick's right. In a perfect world, we would try to concentrate on real fraud and make life easy. As our first speaker explained, the difficulties for employers, make it easy for those who are good, for good cases. But what has happened throughout my professional life is that promises never get kept. The enforcement part, as James said, never happens, and all you get is the amnesties. And then you end up with this sort of sclerosis of legitimate employers as well as unscrupulous ones relying on a never-ending chain of either illegal labor or cheap labor, undercutting the American workforce, and nothing ever happens. So, you know, at this point, I've kind of lost hope for reform. I think bipartisan reform went out with the Gang of Eight or whatever it was. If you look at the Jordan Commission of 94, I think they released a report, and then you had IRIRA in 96. That was the last time that you had serious people in the Democratic and Republican Party, in my view, working on reform. And they concluded that we needed, in the national interest, we should crack down on illegal immigration and make legal immigration more streamlined and quicker and better. And of course, that didn't happen. We only did half of those things. And then, of course, now we've seen the wild swing between the Biden and the Trump administrations on enforcement. But I wanted to talk just a little bit about H-1Bs. And I wrote a fairly long paper on this for the Heritage Foundation pretty recently. So if you're interested in knowing more about that, please do read that. If you're not already more of an expert than me on H-1Bs, which is probable for many of you out there. The bottom line, though, I'm looking at this not from a practitioner's point of view, either as someone who's done tens of thousands of visa interviews, including H's, and sent many of them back for fraud concerns, and also issued many that were in total compliance with the law. I think the basic premise that underlies these is faulty. One is that labor, human beings are just labor units. And you can transfer them from India to America or from, you know, Burkina Faso to Belgium. And it doesn't really matter as long as they can make the same cars in the same time. What language they speak, what culture they belong to, what values they have, what religion they have, what history they share. None of that matters. It's simply a matter of labor units. And I think that's a dangerous path to go down. I think the H-1B was designed to be a supplement to the American workforce and not a replacement to it. And can you still hear me? I'm seeing. Yeah. I'm going to keep talking. Give me a throat cutting gesture. Randy, if you want me to stop. Okay, I got a thumbs up. So ideally, I hope we would all agree that a worker visa program ought to put American workers first and ought to supplement them, not undercut them. And what's happened with the H-1B over the years is it's gone from 65,000 specialized workers capped every year, renewable once, but not necessarily always leading to a green card, to being basically an immigrant visa for one country, India, which is, 75% of all H-1Bs. And the lobbying and the corporate interests that have gotten into the H-1B are now extremely strong politically, and it makes it hard to go back to that basic premise of, are these visas necessary? Well, what would happen if there wasn't a labor shortage? What if we could actually show that there wasn't a shortage of skilled workers in the United States? And I think that's what's happening now. There is simply no evidence for a labor shortage in the STEM fields. You could say, and I think that what I could live with is if, you know, Microsoft or one of these AI firms were to say, look, these 10 engineers, these are the nuts. We need these guys. They're just that good. I can't live without them. Fine. Amazon, whatever. You got, 100, a handful. But what they're doing is they're hiring 10,000 people on H-1Bs. And meanwhile, they're letting go 10,000 American workers, some of whom are, the children of H-1Bs who came a generation ago. And you see this right across the industry, from Southern California Electric to Disney, American workers being undercut either by lower salaries or simply being fired and replaced with foreign workers. The fraud is rife right throughout the system. The best H-1Bs I ever saw were people who went to the Indian Institute of Technology, and they were going to work at some name brand firm I'd heard of, going to be paid an above market wage because they had a particular skill. I got that. But what you see, the data shows, is that I think 80%+ of H-1Bs are paid below the prevailing wage. There is fraud at every level of the process, not, of course, in every case, but there are body shops that will petition for hundreds of H-1Bs that they will leave, mostly in India, until they find a job for them, which is exactly the opposite of the way it's supposed to work. There's supposed to be the shortage first and then the job. And what we've seen is that wages have not gone up in the high-tech fields because there's this backdoor to the labor market. So you have a higher unemployment rate among U.S. STEM graduates than among graduates in, the liberal arts and the studies degrees, which makes no sense at all. But one of the reasons is, and you all know the mechanism by which $65,000 roughly is the cap for salary, so that's the floor. If that had been rising with inflation, it'd be more like $150,000 today. You wouldn't be able to hire someone for $65,000. But we routinely see H-1Bs where people are being paid $50,000, $55,000 to do a supposedly specialized job. Well, you cannot live on $55,000 in a major U.S. metropolitan area today. And so what I would advocate, and I advocate in the paper, is not to scrap the H-1B entirely, although I'm somewhat sympathetic to that view, given the unemployment in our youth and the threat of AI, which is going to unemploy even more of our young people. And we should put them first. I think that's always in the national interest. But I think we need to scale it back to 65,000, not make it an automatic path to a green card, keep the country tasks, keep this visa in the box which Congress put it in, rather than making it into a cheap labor program on a mass scale. Look, I understand businesses are not people. I know they are corporations or people in a certain legal sense, but they're there to make money. They're there to, like sharks, they swim forward and they eat stuff. I have no problem with that. They're not. They don't have a soul and a conscience. It's the government's role to put some limits on corporations. And the package said to give them some guidance to say, here's what we're going to allow, here's what we're not, and not make it so that in this state, you can hire illegal people to work in your plant. And in this state, you can, which makes it impossible to predict and impossible to you know, plan for the future for businesses. So in a nutshell, I think the H-1B, and I could talk about the L-1 visa and the O-1, which is now being used for OnlyFans and porn stars. All of these work visas have been expanded way beyond the scope that they were intended for, and they need to be reformed so that fundamentally we put the interests of American workers and graduates first, and we only use work visas as a way to supplement and add an elite layer rather than a mass labor program. And with that, I think I will pass it back to the moderator. Thank you.
So you don't support the program, I guess, as currently constructed?
Not as currently constructed, no.
I know, that's a little bit of a joke. So, so Patrick, I'm not going to ask you to push back on all those things, but I mean, just generically, let me start with two questions. We have some from the crowd out here. But Patrick, why do you think, you've heard Simon, but, you know, back in the day with Senator Abraham, like I said, we pushed through a bill that raised H-1Bs to 185,000, I think, for 3 years. And of course, now it's back down to 65 and 85 universities. And now it's, of course, it's in the target of the administration. What do you think has changed over all these years, Patrick? And other than H-1B dependence, I don't remember much really being substantively changed in the program. And perhaps we should have changed it when I was at the chamber to address some of these concerns. But any kind of just sort of universal comments on that, Patrick, even in the war on this for quite some time?
And, you know, I still stick with what I said earlier, which is I don't want to push back on Simon on everything he said, because, you know, one, as a consular officer, he observed things firsthand. I can't, right? I'm not in the position to question that. We don't deny that fraud can happen. And I'm sure it did. And I'm sure that on the front line, James and Simon saw plenty of it. But it goes to my point, you know, that I was making as well, which is, what is the solution, right? And, you know, I would say maybe I'm not as skeptical of, you know, the chances of reform and repair the system as I'm, you know, coming from his perspective. Just a few things I do want to point out, which is when used properly, right, with the H-1B or any visa system, there should not be an incentive. I know I'm talking, ideology here, but there should not be an incentive to hire foreign workers over Americans, because there is a prevailing wage requirement. If you're undercutting U.S. workers, right, there is, you know, there are laws against that, and there is enforcement from the Labor Department, right? Project Firewall that Chris mentioned, you know, I don't have sufficient data to give feedback on how it's going yet, right? But the idea that the government is going to enforce the laws on the books should not be offensive to certainly not to our audience today, right? But at the same time, you know, what businesses need, right? What a 21st century global economy needs is the right talent in the right place at the right time. So, you know, so that's why I still emphasize that, look, let's make access to global talent available, punish those who are breaking the laws, make sure that the mechanisms to protect American workers are actually working. And I think we can make this work. You know, I don't know the percentage, but a significant number of H-1Bs hired by, you know, employers ranging from startups to small business to, yes, big tech as well. They're hired from U.S. campuses. And these companies don't go on to the schools and say, hey, you know, show me all your Indians and Chinese, right? They go and say, hey, I want to look at the top 10%, 5% if you're graduating class in life sciences, engineering, whatever it is. And just, you know, as the percentages work, you're going to have a number of people that need H-1B visas, right? Or any visas. H-1B is the most, is the one that's most obvious.
Yeah. Hey, Patrick, let me just jump in, because I know James has to run a little early. So let's get back to E-Verify. With Chris, you and I have talked to E-Verify, and one of the problems has been, and James, I want you that there's not a firewall between the enforcement and the E-Verify people, and that literally an E-Verify person at CIS or whatever it is, could see some issue or something with regard to verification and walk down the hall to the enforcement people and sort of, hey, maybe you want to go investigate that employer. And isn't that a deterrent, or could that be solved, or how big of an issue is that, just because we've talked about it?
I think that's a deterrent to from employers that might be unscrupulous and abusing the system. And it encourages compliance and scrupulous, you know, careful adherence to what's required. Like Simon talked about, the problem with all these grand compromises we've had is that the enforcement never happens. And you've seen multiple times in this century attempts at similar compromises, and they always fail because everyone knows that the amnesty will happen and the enforcement won't. And so that compromise, I think that cooperation between the sides of DHS, to the extent it happens, is a good thing, because to the extent that enforcement actually does happen to hold employers and employees who are breaking the law accountable, it makes it possible for there to be compromise between the different sides, because they'll see that the enforcement actually is happening.
Chris, do you have any views on that?
Yeah, I don't disagree entirely with what James is saying, right? It's a lot of the clients we have, they're going through enforcement actions that are under investigation, going through I-9 audits. They say, like, we're cool with this if we can have a level playing field, but we're the ones getting hit right now. And all of our competitors out there just ended up hiring all the people that ICE took away from us, right? Because they're still out. They weren't removed from the country. But more to James's point, the concern I have is maybe twofold. I would say, number one, we have people who are real lacking in sophistication in the smaller companies. They enroll in E-Verify, they want to do the right thing, they're excited about it. And then they start to accrue tentative non-confirmations, which is when you get an initial mismatch on the person's identity or employment authorization in the government system. And they don't know quite how to navigate it. Maybe they let it sit too long. And we've seen a number of cases at this point where, because they didn't follow through on those processes as effectively as they should have, it does trigger an audit or an investigation. And in fact, agents have been fairly candid about it. Yeah, we got a notification from E-Verify that your client was falling short. So I'd point to that, number one. I think in addition to that, I would just point to how easily the system can be beaten, right? We had a company get raided recently that was enrolled in E-Verify. They said, wait a second, we're enrolled in E-Verify, we're trying to do everything right. And the uniform response from the agents was, yeah, everybody knows E-Verify is broken. James, I think you're right. I think it does reduce, to some extent, the number of fraudulent producers of documentation. But it's not that hard to steal somebody's identity, apparently, in the current environment. And that's what we're seeing. You get I'm Patrick Shen, and I slap my photo on an ID card that has his identifying data. And then I get a social security card that has his social security number on it. I'm going to sail through every time. So that's kind of led to a two-front approach in the world of enforcement, too. Is the identity of the person really the person who produced the card? We've seen that one, right? Where somebody's producing cards that doesn't quite look exactly, or even maybe close to the person who presented it. And then number two, does the documentation appear on its face to be authentic? The courts have uniformly held that employers are not required to be document experts, but I think to some extent they are increasingly expected to be better, at least at starting to screen and assess whether documentation is fraudulent or not. So, long-winded answer of saying E-Verify probably helps, but I'm not sure that it's the cure for the situation. It's going to take more than that.
Yeah, and if I could just jump on, since I'm moderator here, prerogative, both Patrick and Chris's, I just think one of the issues always from the employer standpoint is complying with the law. There are bad apples, but I've written on this also, Simon, but in I-9 compliance is there are cases out there, and there's a famous case called Fisher Homes, which occurred under Chertoff and Bush, where ICE went in and just obliterated this medium-sized company with ridiculous enforcement demands, took 3 years of this and that, and eventually they didn't even bring the case, but this company spent millions in defending itself. Unfortunately, it had the resources to do that. And that occurs, my research shows, talking to practitioners, that still occurs now. So it's not like, hey, you're a bad guy, we're going to fine you. And there are people out there, but go after them. Don't spend your time on these small little technical violations. And Patrick's had some experience with that also. Where the balance is, I don't know. For me, it's Equal Access to Justice Act reform so that small businesses can get their attorney's fees and costs reimbursed easily when they win a case against ICE or whoever. But that's a little separate agenda I have going on for 10 years here, and one day I'll get that done.
I apologize. Ready. I'll stop off for a court hearing. Just wanted to conclude by saying E-Verify obviously isn't perfect, but it's better than what we have. And so there's never going to be a perfect system. We might as well adopt something that's better than the I-9 system, which fails. And it's a lot harder to get a fake photo ID than it is to just get a fake Social Security card. So there's going to be less fraud than there is now, at least. I appreciate the chance to speak, and I apologize for having to drop off early.
Thanks a lot, James. Appreciate you joining.
Thanks, James.
Good luck. Patrick, I cut you sort of off on the H-1B defense.
And no, that's okay. If this group, if I have the pleasure of staying in touch with everyone in this group, I would love to share more of my bad experiences, that's for us all, to consider and maybe to work from the same sheet. One of the problems with E-Verify also during the Obama and Biden administrations, and I apologize for it being sounding political here. It's not my intent. And hopefully this is not antithetical to our Federalist Society's mandate here. But, one of the issues that we saw during Democratic administrations is that E-Verify would refer cases, any kind of an anomaly, could be honest mistakes, to the DOJ Civil Rights Division to investigate for discrimination. Now, Randy, you're the expert on EEOC Title VII. I don't know how EEOC does with investigations, but the Justice Department's Office of Special Counsel, now called the IER, Immigrant and Employee Rights Section, when you give them a case, rarely do you see them go through the facts. Goes, yep, you're right, there's nothing here, right? They drag them through, a lengthy investigation. Many times, in cases where the employer used E-Verify correctly, right? An employee was upset about something and makes these allegations. And no matter what you do, it drags on. Now, in my last job, we represented large multinational and U.S. employers. They had the resources to pay me. And you know what? It was fine, right? I paid for 2 college educations and 2 weddings with, those BS cases, right? And that was fine. But as you said, impact on medium to small sized businesses, and also just right or wrong. Right. So if we're going to mandate E-Verify, not only should there be safe harbor for employers who use it correctly against allegations of illegal employment, but if you use it correctly, you should not be subject to frivolous discrimination allegations.
Yeah,
it's just not fair.
Simon,
you're mute.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. And like I said, I've become jaded over the years at how all this goodwill has gone into trying to reform immigration in everybody's best interest, and it never seems to work. But absolutely, small businesses should not be put in a position ever of being sued for discrimination. Well, but we could go into the whole disparate impact thing. It's a whole separate conversation. If they're doing their due diligence, I've spoken to, my brother ran a small business in California, and his ability to verify documents was very limited.
So we're turning the corner. I do have one question here from what looks like an aspiring immigration lawyer. Thank you for taking the time to speak today. I'm genuinely interested in immigration law, but I'm still trying to understand what the entry points into the practice look like for law students. What would you recommend? Where would you recommend starting? And Chris, you probably have a viewpoint from in private practice with a law firm. Patrick, you and I would probably have different ones, cutting our eye teeth on Capitol Hill. And Simon, you're in a think tank. But Chris, why don't you jump in here? And how did you get started? And what would you recommend to some aspiring young kid?
Well, there are three types of immigration practices out there that I think we need to point to. The first one is what I'm doing primarily these days, which is representing companies that are under investigation or going through I-9 audits. Second type is the type of immigration lawyer that's bringing people in legally. We're bringing them in on H-1Bs, L-1s, TNs, on and on the alphabet soup goes, and then helping them stay by pursuing permanent residence in the country. And then the third type is kind of outside of the bigger law firm world and more in the smaller practices, deportation defense, asylum applications, family-based immigration. So I think step one is to figure out which of those three categories interests you the most. And then that kind of helps you understand which direction you're going to need to go. Do you want to go to the big law firms? That's probably one of the first two options. Do you want to go to the smaller deportation defense type realm? Then you're going to go to one of the smaller boutiques.
Interesting points. Yeah. Simon, what are your thoughts on that? Anything?
Well, having two kids who are trying to enter the workforce and one of whom is going to law school in the fall, I can feel this. So what I would say in very general terms are, one, specialize. At some point, if you like something, get really good at it. Because even with AI, all of you on this call are experts in one thing. And the more you know about a particular thing and become known as that person, I think the more you're going to be marketable. And the second is, be flexible. The careers that that were open to me 35 years ago, many of them don't exist anymore. So you've got to be general and don't worry so much about the first step on the path. If you want to be a lawyer, or even if you want to be an immigration lawyer, just take the first thing that looks reasonable and go with that. And then the last point, and this is maybe a little too technical, but for young people, don't borrow a lot of money.
I agree.
If you go to law school, you go to one of the top law schools and you get really good grades, you're probably going to pay off whatever loans you borrow. But if those two things don't apply, you do not want to saddle yourself with a lifetime of debt for a career that you may not be all that serious about.
That's exactly what I've told my kids at Syracuse College of Law. And they're going. Patrick, how about you? You've been around the horn a little bit.
Yeah, a little too. I'm going to just support what Chris and Simon said. I don't have anything more to add except to say that I'm so glad that my two kids, the first one majored in kinesiology, the second one majored in chemistry. So that should tell you how I feel about young people entering the legal profession.
Well, to Simon's point, never turned down an opportunity. I remember at the chamber when I mostly was hired to work on the ergonomics issue in employment law and Title VII. And Tom Donahue said, well, Randy, you're doing a good job on those. You want to work on immigration? And I'm like, okay, sure. How could that be? Of course, I didn't get a raise in salary, but it's been a challenge working in the immigration field, but I've never looked back and thought it was boring or regretted that decision. So we're at 12:50. So take opportunities, go with what you feel and makes you happy. And if your alarm clock goes off and you don't want to go to work, you got to find another job. That's what I say to my kids most days. Well, we're at this. Thank you, panel. I think this has been very good and very helpful. We covered a lot of areas. And Matt, maybe we can do something at some other time as things develop in the courts or in the administration.
Yeah, thank you all very much. Thank you for your patience, especially you, the speakers. Thank you for your time and expertise today. So on behalf of FedSoc, we're very grateful. And for you, the audience, thank you for joining us. Keep your eye on your emails and on our website for future events. Thank you. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.